One of the reasons I entered the ministry was to help reclaim the word Christian. It bothered me that the heart of the Christian message seems to get buried beneath layers of legalism, self-righteous judgments, and visions of a God from whose anger we must be saved. I make no secret of the fact that I believe fundamentalism in all its forms, Christian, Jewish, and Islamic, is a disease upon otherwise beautiful faiths. I'm aware that in this sermon, there will be times when I myself sound judgmental toward the fundamentalists, but that's not my intention. The fact is, I believe they have a right to envision God however they want. I believe they have the right to live their lives however they want. But I'm terribly frustrated they do not feel the same way toward me and toward you, that they feel obliged to do everything possible to inflict their narrow religious views on the rest of the world. And most of all, I am sickened that they resort to what I believe is child abuse, emotional abuse, in trying to scare our children into their way of thinking. I have to guard against spending too much time attacking fundamentalism, because the effect would be to hinder our own faith journeys. It's not enough to know what you're against, you have to know what you're for. Since I believe love of God and love of neighbor are the foundations of a good life, those subjects serve as the foundation for most of my sermons. But every now and then I have to get a few things off my chest, and today's one of those days. Two things prompted me to write this morning's message. First, the Halloween hell houses various churches have set up around town and around the nation, as they always do at this time of year. And second, a group of articles in the Faith and Values section of the Wichita Eagle a few weeks back, in which both local and national ministers proclaim that the end is near and Jesus will be returning soon. This obvious fact, they say, is evidenced by the fulfillment of biblical prophecy currently taking place on planet Earth. First, I'm sure most of you have heard about the Halloween houses, also called judgment houses or hell houses, that pop up around Halloween. Let me give you the one paragraph summary. A church advertises its Halloween party, promising a scary time for all the community's teens. The youth group is encouraged to bring all their unsaved friends who are sure to be scared into believing in Jesus. The children and teens are walked through a religiously twisted haunted house in which teens like themselves are seen drinking or smoking or having abortions or any of the other things that assure eternity in hell. And after about 30 minutes of seeing horrid images, hearing the screams of people suffering eternal torment in hell, and smelling often Limburger cheese being heated to make the whole experience as nauseating as possible, they're taken into one last perfumed room where they see Jesus hanging on the cross, having died for their sins. They are approached by the minister or the youth minister and are told they have a decision to make. They will either spend eternity in heaven or hell, and their eternal fate is being determined at this very moment. Sign this confession of faith in Jesus Christ or go to hell forever. And thanks for coming. Send your friends. These folks really know how to put the fun back in fundamentalism. As for all the ministers predicting the end of the world, you'll hopefully recall that I did a two-week series on this past summer on the book of Revelation, which I hope did a good job of explaining why that book was written in the first place and how ridiculous it is to treat it like a prediction of the fate of planet Earth 2,000 years after the writing of the book. Since we covered that subject rather fully, I won't spend this morning going over that same old ground. Instead, I want to ask three questions and provide possible answers to each of those questions. The way we answer these three questions determines how we approach the life of faith. The three questions are, number one, who or what is God? Number two, why are we here? Why were we created? Number three, how do we live lives that please God? Question number one, who or what is God, is answered in the title of today's sermon. Three of the more prominent ways of thinking about God are as a divine trickster, an angry father, or love. Let's consider each of the three possible answers. God, the divine trickster. This is a pretty common way of thinking about God. It's based on a truth, namely, that we can never fully know the mind of God. But oh, how that truth can get twisted into something ugly. The fact that we can never claim to know the fullness of God is a fact that should keep us humble, but more importantly, it should lead us into a life of faith. And our faith, it seems to me, should be faith that God is good. That in spite of all the evils of the world and all the trials and tribulations life throws in our paths, God is with us rather than against us. That cannot be said of the divine trickster model of God. Part of this model is based on the idea that God is in complete control of absolutely everything that happens. If your child gets run over by the school bus, that is God's will. God planned the whole thing. It happened exactly as it was supposed to happen. If you become ill or suffer some personal tragedy, that too is a part of the plan. When the Black Plague wiped out one-third of Europe, that was God doing what God does. We don't understand it, but who are we to question God's will? And worst of all, this divine trickster created each and every one of us and placed us in this world with the knowledge that almost all of us would suffer eternal damnation. We are created for the purpose and with the intent that we will go to hell. But some of us are lucky. We're raised in a culture where the dominant religion is the right religion, and all we have to do is practice the religion our parents handed on to us, and we get to escape God's plan of eternal damnation and live forever in heaven. What I have just described is the basic belief of the fundamentalists in both Christianity and Islam. Because the fundamental elements in both of those religions teach the people of the cultures where those religions are dominant that all you have to do is practice your parents' faith, the religion that is most prevalent in your culture, and adhere to the tenets of that religion, and you'll be saved from damnation. And those fundamentalists point at the fundamentalists from the other religion and call them heathens or hell-bound infidels. In the fundamental faction of Christianity, the idea is that the divine trickster has hidden a series of complex riddles within the Bible. The Bible is a sort of code book with lots of riddles providing everything from certain knowledge about how the world will end to how to win the game of life, the save your soul game. And the great thing about it is this: winning the game has absolutely nothing to do with being a good person. It's all about believing the right things. You can spend your entire life committing beautiful acts of charity and caring deeply for the earth and all its inhabitants, and that means nothing. All that matters is that you solve the riddle, make the proper confession of faith, and tell as many others as possible about how to be saved. The second model of God is the angry father model. And this model is similar in many ways to the divine trickster, but this time, he's not just hard to figure out, he's mad. While the first model says we can't hope to understand the terrible things God does, this model says we can understand it because God is punishing us continually for our sins. If you get sick, you deserved it. When a hurricane strikes Florida, It's because of all the gays down there. When a hijacker pilots a jet into the World Trade Center and kills thousands of innocent people, it's God's righteous anger being vented on America for not adopting the ultra-conservative political agenda espoused by the religious right. When you consider those first two models of God, it's no surprise that many modern theologians don't even like to use the word God. It has too much baggage with it. When we hear that word, God, a flood of images comes pouring out of our subconscious and rushing to our conscious minds, and those images are usually some sort of twisted amalgam of the divine trickster and the angry father models of God. And it's too bad, because there really isn't any word or words that can take the place of that word, God. Theologians have certainly tried. The divine ground, the ground of being, being itself, ultimate concern, absolute mystery, the attempts to get rid of the word God are frequent and sincere and always failures. And that brings us to the third answer to the question, who or what is God? And the answer is love. It sounds almost trite. God is love. And while I don't believe that fully defines God, I believe it is the best working definition we have. What called the universe into being in the first place? Was it a divine trickster? An angry father? Or was it a love so incomprehensible that creation burst forth with everything that is simply because God had to have something to love? What holds the universe together moment to moment, breathing life into our lungs as we are called forth from the dust? Is it a divine trickster watching to see if we figure out the game? Is it an angry father ready to send the overwhelming majority of us to eternal torment? Or is it a love so pure that our human efforts at love are at best a pale reflection? And I want to mention something about Jesus, about the cross. In my personal theology, Jesus is the central figure in human history. In my personal theology, the cross is the central event in human history. When I want a glimpse of God's unfathomable love, I find it best expressed in the cross of Jesus. I am never closer to God than when, in prayer, I place myself at the foot of the cross. I see in that mysterious event something that calls me directly into the presence of God's love, something so powerful it just breaks down the barrier between time and eternity. In the presence of such a love, we should be very cautious about claiming certain people are beyond the reach of God if they do not practice faith the way we do. For me, the cross is a symbol of love, God's ultimate statement that we are loved. There may be other models for God, other answers to the question, who or what is God? But for me, God is love comes close enough to get me through this life. Which leads to the second question. Why are we here? Hopefully we've all spent a little time thinking about this one. I mean, embracing this question is one of the main things that makes us human beings. We're the only creatures on this planet who can examine the world for meaning. Of course, this ability to ask this question causes all sorts of problems. Philosopher Martin Heidegger said we all have a sense of having been thrown into this world. We didn't ask to be here, but here we are. One of my favorite songs from way back when, Riders on the Storm, says, "Into this house we're born, into this world we're thrown, like a dog without a bone, like an actor out on loan." I think we've all felt like that at one time or another. Psychoanalyst Carl Jung said that about one-third of his cases involved no clinically definable neurosis, but a simple feeling of the senselessness and emptiness of life. We can't help but ask the question, why are we here? And how we answer that question has a lot to do with how we answered that first question about the nature of God. If God is a divine trickster, then we're here to solve the riddle and escape this world after our death. The whole point of this life lies in what comes after. In fact, with this model, these bodies are little more than prisons which hold our eternal spirits for a short time, long enough for our eternal fate to be determined. But life itself has no meaning, except that it provides us with the opportunity to escape it and get to heaven. If God is an angry father, we're here to try to escape God's anger. And once again, with the angry father model, people have it all figured out. We escape God's wrath by making the proper confessions of faith. But what if God is love? If God is love, then love itself must have a great deal to do with why we are here. And let me be just as serious as I can be here. I don't believe in vast and intricate theological arguments. I enjoy theology and spend what is probably a ridiculous amount of my time reading it. But my entire theology can be narrowed down to a simple statement. Love is the only reason we exist. I believe that with everything I am, love is the only reason we exist. Love is the only power in the universe great enough to call reality into being in the first place, and it is the power of love that sustains creation moment to moment. And we can write symphonies and build skyscrapers and launch rockets to the edge of the Milky Way, and it's good that we do those things, but it is only love that justifies our being. And that's why we're here. The world isn't something evil we need to figure out a way of escaping. We are born to fall madly in love with this world and with everybody and everything in it. I really believe that. God is love, and we become what we are born to be when we find ways to bring love into this world. Which leads us nicely to question number 3, how do we live lives that please God? If you go to one of the Halloween hell houses that local churches have set up, the answer will become clear. We please God by following in the correct religion, in the correct way, which is founded on saying and believing the correct things about Jesus. If you read the articles being written by and about ministers who are convinced Jesus is coming back again and soon, and that this time he's mad, then the way we please God is by properly interpreting the hidden messages in the Bible. And I have to remind you of my conviction. The people who are obsessed with the second coming of Jesus are the people who didn't care for the Jesus we got the first time around. That first Jesus was all about love and forgiveness and caring for others and not judging other people. But the Jesus of the second coming, at least the one envisioned by the religious prophets of doom who are gleefully awaiting the cataclysmic end of the world, this new Jesus will be just the opposite of the guy we got the first time. No more love, no more forgiveness, no more caring for people who don't practice religion the right way, no more tolerance for those who refuse to judge the infidels and heathens. Next time, we are promised, the Jesus we get will be just as self-righteous, mean-spirited, and judgmental as the people who keep warning us he's on the way. But for those of us who believe that God is love, and who believe that the only reason we exist is to be loving people ourselves, for us, pleasing God just isn't all that difficult. We managed to cut through 2,000 years of Christian theology and narrow it down to a few basic principles. First, we know we're not perfect, but we believe God's love will more than cover our mistakes. Second, we don't know exactly what happens when we die, but we believe God is in complete control of that situation, and we trust God with the things we cannot know. We trust God. That's what our faith is all about. Third, we believe Jesus affords us the best window into how life should be lived, which means we should love God and love our neighbors, and we should not judge other people. After all, Jesus was not ambivalent on the subject. He told us again and again that is exactly what we're supposed to do. And last, But certainly not least, we can turn to the very scriptures that shaped Jesus himself and find in the words of the prophet Micah a simple and, we believe, adequate description of how to live lives that please God. I've closed sermons with these words before, and I will do it again in the future. The words are that important. They are a roadmap for the journey through life. I leave you with the words of Micah 6:8. What does the Lord require of you but to do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with your God? It's just not that hard.